Accession number 28355, Reel 6.
You were saying that you were trying to get this chap to change station.
Yeah, and he changed.
Or turn
the radio
to
off.
Turn it down.
But he changed stations, and there we were, halfway from Amman on our way to Petra, going down the King's Highway there. And what should we hear on the radio? But this is British Forces Broadcasting Station, Cyprus. The next meeting at Wives Club in Limassol will be such and such. Our attempts to get away from Equatorial Cyprus slightly failed. But that was the first time we went to Petra. I've been fortunate to go many times, not a number of times since. But it was. So all of that, I mean, we started with a presumption we were in that far east of UK. If we were ever going to be able to afford to do any holidaying from UK, it would probably be west of Cyprus rather than east, so we kept going east. That's why we went to Turkey, I got into Iran, we went to Lebanon, I mentioned. It was all very much more peaceful there, it was just between the real troubles, apart from having to fly around Israel, you couldn't fly over it.
I'm going to ask you two things. One, why did you have to fly over Israel? And secondly, I see that you left in December 73. That would be, if my memory serves me right, after the Yom Kippur War.
Yes, sure, yes. It had. I'm talking about, this was going to Jordan.
Yeah.
To get to Jordan from Cyprus, you had to go down the Suez Canal, effectively, or overflight, and then up the Gulf of Aqaba.
Yes. And so why the no-overfly rights, no-overfly?
Because Israel didn't let you.
Really?
In those days, yes, oh yes. Yes, no, we didn't want Israel to fly over us, and so they wouldn't want us to fly over them. So there was a bit of a standoff, and also if there was going to be any form of hostilities, which we wouldn't necessarily know about, we didn't want to be exposed to those. So for all those reasons, it was deemed sensible not to. We were just beginning to become a bit more friendly with the Egyptians because, of course, we'd had a pretty good standoff. And I can remember we invited some Egyptian Air Force officers to come over. And the idea was really to discuss flight safety and air sea rescue. But they had interpreted as recovery rather than rescue. And so they were thinking of wreck recovery or crashed aircraft recovery rather than the picking up of aircrew which might have crashed. So we got on very well together, but it was an early example, as far as I can remember, of us beginning to sort of be allowed to talk again to the Egyptians. We were able to overfly them, but we certainly hadn't had any meetings, sort of air force to air force, and this was seen as a way of sort of getting the turn, because both of us had an interest. You know, if there was an air incident or a crash somewhere in the Mediterranean between Cyprus and Egypt, both of us would want to be able to do something about it. So up till that time, there'd been no contacts. So this was an attempt to.
So there were no contacts really at that level.
No.
In that part of the world.
There may have been
post 57, post 56.
Bear in mind, I'm talking as the station commander at Akrotiri. I'm not in day-to-day contact with my headquarters as to what they're up to. When I get pulled in or something like this exchange with the Egyptians, but it's not part of my direct interest or responsibility. I've got more than enough to do to run a station and keep on top of that. So there may have been things going on, which maybe with the benefit of hindsight now I could sort of identify just as you are, but I wasn't myself involved with them or just even aware of them during my time as station commander at Cyprus. Anyway, one lives slightly cocooned in the world in which you're expected to operate.
Yes. And the Yom Kippur War, to what extent did that have any...
I don't remember it being of direct. I mean, we obviously were intelligence and so on, but that again wasn't my direct responsibility. I wasn't running the intelligence units, so what they were up to, and I'm sure they were up to things, I'm not in a position to recount or to tell anything about those.
Right. Well, thank you. December 73, then, back to the UK.
Back to UK for the Royal College of St. Cyprus. We'd bought a house down, I think I mentioned, in Woking, so we went back there. And my next appointment was Royal College of Defence Studies as a student. I was delighted to be there. It was a good year, excellent comrade in the shape of John Barraclough, and rather like my time at Andover Staff College. Of course, the RCDS is a big mix of nationalities, so one gets to know a variety of people, which includes the present president of Nigeria, Oluwa Obasanjo, who was a student on my course, or I was a student on the same course as him. And I'm not sure that there's sort of much one wants to pull out of the RCDS period.
Well, I do have one question relating to something that Julian Oswald said to me.
Yes.
He said, I said, was this taxing? He said, no.
Yeah.
And then immediately he went on to say, but what it did give you time was to think and to do your own work if you wished.
Mm.
Was that how you found it? And
yes, I mean, after running Akrotiri or any of the other sort of more senior appointments I'd had, RCDS, you had no responsibility except for yourself, and that was a complete change. And I've always looked upon it as a period for recharging batteries, making contacts, networking. Yes. Going through a lot of studies on a list of different subjects, some new to you, some more familiar to you, but it broadens your horizons, and both in the people you meet, their attitudes. I mean, I think that was the first time, not quite the first time, because I think it was even earlier, that you realize that some people's Near East is somebody else's Near North or Far North or whatever. And the particular tour I went on, because as the students go off on various tours, the one I went on was mainly Africa. We went to Ghana and Nigeria and then across to Kenya. And we had been going down to the Congo, but I think Muhammad Ali was fighting somebody down there, and there were all the hotels we should have been able to get into, we couldn't get into, so we actually had to kick our heels for a little while in Kenya and go on safari, which was very agreeable. But there's one little anecdote, which I'm not sure whether I should tell, but I think as everybody's dead, it doesn't matter. When we arrived in Nigeria, I was the senior student, and the directing staff was with me, was Admiral Wilson, lovely man. And he and I had been singled out to go and stay with the High Commissioner. And it was the middle of the afternoon when we arrived in Lagos, so somebody picked us up in a car and we drove off to presumably the High Commissioner's residence. And a large local lady met us and showed us to our rooms, and I assumed, or Slab Wilson assumed, that the High Commissioner was in his office. Oh no, says the large lady, High Commissioner in garden. So we go down the garden to find the High Commissioner, indeed, in the garden, laid out flat on the sunbed, wearing absolutely nothing but a Panama hat, which really stood out from his head to his midriff. So one felt that the pressures of work on the High Commission in Nigeria on that particular day, I don't know what it's like otherwise.
Not too taxing.
But anyway, but Nigeria was a... I mean, Nigeria has... I mean, is never really settled as a country. I mean, it's enormous, potentially very rich. But corruption, I visited much later as Chief of Defence Staff, and I never felt really comfortable there. But, I mean, they're friendly enough. There were two Nigerians, I think I mentioned on my particular course, Uluwa Obasanjo is now the president. The other one, Ilia Bisala, I got to know quite well. But one of the things we used to do was to have a number of the foreigners round to our house, to, as we did at Andover, to have a meal and a chat. Ilya came more than once. He was a different tribe to Ulu, and fairly soon after the end of the course, I can't remember, maybe a year, there was yet another coup, and Ilya got topped, and a few months later, Ulu was in charge. It was an interesting sort of insight, because it took me right back, funnily enough, to my time with Chief of Defence Staff in Dick Hull's time. I don't think I mentioned this, but the CDS used to run an annual conference, whose name escapes me, which was attended by senior military officers from the Commonwealth, particularly from the new Commonwealth. And I think I certainly attended two of these. But they weren't the same faces that came. Not because they retired and put their feet up, but because they've been topped or, you know, in jail or something. And, it was the first time I went back to Nigeria. I was very conscious of this earlier experience. So I wasn't surprised to learn that soon after he went back, the Ghanaian who'd been on our course and went to be in charge of the border guard, and I think was shipping Mercedes in or out, I can't remember which direction, but he too got topped. So it was a rather more sort of brutal type of regimes. And of course, Nigeria had had all this trouble with Biafra and but one was made welcome, but you weren't totally sure that you'd be talking to the same people some months or years later.
It must have been a bit...
And it's still like that, you see.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, the chap before Uluwa Obasanjo, I did meet when I went out on the CDS. I didn't like him then, and he went on. And I don't think he was a very popular chap. He got rid of, and I can't remember exactly what happened to him. Different culture altogether.
Reminiscent of being in Stalinist Russia in the 30s, where there are mini purges. Well, there were huge purges, of course, in Stalinist Russia, but there are mini purges going on if you've got the wrong tribe or.
Yes, yes.
The balance of power shifts.
Balance of power does shift. Anyway, so what else about RCDS? I think that's about all. I then went off to do a study at the request of AMP, who is Neil Cameron, into the ground branches of the RAF, the admin and supply, and with a view to seeing whether to have some sort of changes. And I can't remember the outcome of all that. I think, you know, our recommendations were accepted. But it was something that was totally different from anything I'd sort of had to do before. And I had a good civil servant with me. And it's funny, it was so long ago, I just can't, but it did lead, as the Air Force got smaller, then the small branches, you know, there's by education, supply, admin, one or two others, you know, they weren't sufficiently large to be cohesive, and so they were looking for some form of, well, providing a career structure which could take account of the reducing size of these individual and soon to be literally not viable as separate pillars within the officer corps on the ground branches side. The one stage, I think the idea was to put it all together, including the engineers. The engineers, quite rightly, nor would I have had anything to do with that. But out of that sort of came a more sensible arrangement. And I'm sorry, without looking it up, I can't remember the details, but somebody else can look it up. But it was something I got to, and then I went on to be Assistant Chief of Air Staff Operations.
Before we come to that, this sort of serious piece of internal housekeeping,
yes,
which you did it at the behest of Neil Cameron.
Who was AMP.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Member for Personnel.
Right.
Second Sea Lord. Adjutant General.
Thank you. This was and resulted in cost savings, almost certainly, I would think.
Well, I mean, the structure of the Air Force, they began going through all sorts of changes. We look at the command structure, Bomber Command, Fighter Command, and Coastal Command disappeared. You had ended up with Strike Command. Again, I can't remember the exact dates, but it was about the early 70s. And then there was obviously a need for further housekeeping because the services were getting smaller. The non-viability of these individual branches, they were too small. And there was really a way to sort of create a better balanced ground branch structure for the officers.
You see, my question is this, that there is clearly a request coming down from the top, politically, that says more savings have got to be found. And my question really is this something that Neil Cameron and his senior colleagues are anticipating? So when more savings are required, they can pull out of their back pockets some savings, which in fact is something they would have liked to have done.
No, I think that the rationale for doing this was purely good, sensible housekeeping.
Right.
It wasn't, I'm not sure that it did actually, it didn't, as far as I remember, have any attempt to try and save money with this, but there was clearly from a career, I mean, he was a member for personnel, so it was a personnel issue rather than a financial issue. I mean, obviously finance might not come into it, but the rationale behind it was a personnel and the ground branch structures needed to be looked at. And so often happens, somebody gets pulled in to do it. I happened to be available because I was going to be leaving RCDS in December and I wasn't starting as ACAS Ops still, or whenever it was, sometime in March or April of 75. Rather than having a bit of gardening leave, you know, I was going to do this, so I did this. that sort of fills that a bit in. Then Assistant Chief Air Staff Operations. I think I mentioned it already, haven't I? Till I walked into the office and looked at the office notice board, and I realised, you know, who'd been Assistant Chief Air Staff Operations when I'd been a squadron leader in the thing. But I had a good outfit there.
You're still an Air Commodore?
No, Air Vice Marshal.
Air Vice?
Yeah.
Okay.
There was a connecting door between Akers Pol and my office. Akers Pol was Joe Gilbert. We both worked for the Vice Chief of Air Staff, so we were forever in each other's offices, you know.
His policy,
and operations, but, you know, it's very difficult to say which is which one and which is the other, particularly in a sort of Cold War situation. Do not disturb. I was there till this is 75, and I then moved up to Fortrea's AOC 1 group in Well, yes and no. I mean, it's... I thought about it the other day. What would I say about my time as Akersoft? Because I was very busy. But I don't recall anything which is sort of anecdotal or of sort of detailed interest over and above, you know, what would come out by looking at the official records.
Well, okay.
It sounds rather as though I'm ducking out of it, which I think I am at the moment.
I must ask you then, because the great majority of people who listen to these tapes, of course, are complete amateurs like myself. You must describe your job, please, and tell me actually what it does and how it what your functions are, how you executed them. You've mentioned your opposite
military
policy and.
Yeah, the Assistant Chief of Air Staff had three air commodores working for him, one sort of looking after air defence sides, one looking after operational attack side, I can't remember the exact wording now, and one looking after the sort of air traffic and navigation and things like this. So that there was what you would expect, a sort of normal structure below the Assistant Chief of Air Staff. And those commodores, the directors of ops and the directors of air defence, whatever they're called, all had their own particular staffs within them. And they would be dealing with a whole variety of sort of day-to-day issues which affected the commands, command operations, or, you know, in a way it's difficult to sort of try and generalise about it. But equally, if you don't generalise, you get sort of lost in the detail, and I can't remember all the detail. So that was the structure. I worked very much to the Vice Chief of the Air Staff, and was, you know, his main input, as far as he was concerned, into the Air Force Board, because he would look after both the policy and the operations side. Where is 75? You know, we'd rather reached a sort of a fairly steady state. You know, there were no, at least maybe I'm absolutely wrong, but I just can't remember any sort of great major crises. You know, we'd had umpteen defence reviews and so on. We had, where are we now, 70?
Between 75
and 78. 3 years. 3 years. And it, you know, it just hasn't left in my memory anything which I feel I ought to recall. Maybe if I go back and look and see what was happening and those things, I might. But at the moment, I can't. And I think I'm wasting my time trying out the old time scratching around in it.
No, I understand.
And I'd rather sort of go on then to. I had not anticipated being perhaps as Akersoft quite so long, but they wanted me to go on to a group, commander group, and Joe Gilbert went to 38 group, but at the same time I went to one group, and I don't know whether I might have, I think, you know, one group with the Balkan force, and I'd got a background, the Balkans and Victors for that matter, was a better match. So that's where I was headed. But, you know, I was not unhappy about that. A group commander, you get a lot of your own freedom. You know, you're running your own group organizations. You get around your stations quite a lot. You fly quite a lot. You've got your big brother in the shape of your command headquarters and your CNC, who may or may not agree with everything that's going on, but that was the responsibilities there, you know, with the nuclear force were, you know, important. Not something I was unfamiliar with, you know, because I'd come from both Akrotiri, with the station with that, and from my own time at Coningsby and College of
Well, what nuclear weapons did the Air Force now have?
These were the 165, WE-165s, 155, which were more of a tactical nuclear weapon, because by this time we were gone over to Polaris. But you know, we were still expected to be able to use these things. And
now, tactical nuclear weapon is one used in a battlefield context more than...
I don't myself, you're trying to have a philosophical debate about nuclear weapons. As far as I'm concerned, they all make a bloody big bang, and to contemplate them, to categorize them as strategic or tactical, I think can be very misleading shorthand. Certainly if you're at the receiving end, that doesn't look very tactical. But I think what you meant was that you're unlikely to be penetrating, you know, the Moscow defenses or the main sort of Soviet heartland. So they were peripheral to, rather than sort of getting straight into the heartland of the Soviet Union. So I think that's why they get classified as tactical, because they were going to deal with Soviet forces in Eastern Germany, Poland, sort of that part of the world, rather than deep into the Soviet Union.
Yes. So, once again, in one sense, I have to ask you, as a group commander, you've said you have a lot of freedom, you could go around the station slopper. What was the actual function and responsibilities of what you had to do?
Well, you are a commander, so you're the leader of the group in that sense. You want to be sure that the units under you are performing well, and that if they have any difficulties, they come to you about them, so you establish a good relationship with your station commanders. You want to
group captains.
We're group captains. You certainly want to. You have a formal inspection, because the role in those days was to have annual inspections of stations called AOC's inspections, which were preceded by pre-AOC's inspections, where your staff would go and look at all the various aspects of a unit, you know, from the engineering side, the equipment side, the air traffic operations side, and so on. And your staff would report on what they'd found, and hopefully, you know, if the station was up to snuff, there weren't many adverse criticisms. But if there were any, well, then you could certainly follow them up. I always looked upon the formal inspection by the AOC as a chance to, you know, have the place prepared for a formal inspection, so there was a discipline about it. But I wasn't, as some did, to come in a very heavy way and try and catch people out. Some some inspections were done on that basis. There are various ways of killing the cat, but if they've had a good pre-AOC inspection, then really you're there to go around and give praise where praise was due, or if something had gone wrong, to follow it up and see what has been done. And it's a good housekeeping exercise for the units. Make sure that's all spring cleaning too, in a way, that everything gets looked at properly at least once a year. Much of it is looked at all the time, but inevitably there can be corners which can get overlooked. And certainly when I was a station commander, I would always make a point of visiting every part of my station on a rotational basis, and in somewhat the same way the sort of AOC's inspections were a formal way of doing that. But you didn't just appear just on the day of the formal inspection. I would normally go and fly with one of my units, because when you get into the crew room and talking to the chaps either before we go flying or over a meal afterwards, you'll get a chance of assessing, you know, what morale's like, what bugging people, whether they're going about their job competently, and generally got a feel for it. So all of that is part of being a an air officer commanding. You've got these units you're responsible for, but in order to discharge that responsibility, you've got to be seen to be amongst them. And